You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284 AL Halaiva. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will question the digestion of a native nightshade, spar with the critters that vie for our tomato and pepper harvest, and consider the best methods for managing soil in hoop house production. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul. How are you doing today?
Very well. Pleasure to see you as always. Really excited about our show. We've got a great one all lined up and just so appreciative to be able to cultivate the soil with our community and cultivate our imagination so we can get out there and make them real with the plants and the animals that make it to our dinner plates, hopefully. So we're going to start as we often do, with the celestial session, looking to the heavenly bodies above for inspiration. And we use a couple of different systems. We look at the Hawaiian system of moon phases, and we look at the biodynamic system. And we will begin with the Hawaiian moon calendar. Today's moon phase is brought to you by the 2014 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, a Hanalei Watershed Hui publication. Today's Hawaiian moon phase is Maoli. This is in the Emi, or diminishing, Anahulu, which is one of 3 weeks in the Hawaiian moon calendar system. And Maoli is a daytime moon, and it's in the sky when we are most active in our cultivations and other activities, generally speaking. So imagining that the moon is having a strong influence today over our heads. The beautiful moon rose on Kauai at 4:46 a.m. this morning, reached her transit or highest point in the sky at 11:31 a.m., and she'll set at 6:17 p.m. this evening. A scant 2% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated. And the mana'o of Maoli is that it is the life, heart, seat of life, ghost or spirit. And Maoli is also the fontanelle of an infant, which we'll hear a little bit more about on the medicine chest later in the program. It's said to be a good day for marriages. And the planting recommendations for Maoli moon is to plant dark green vegetation, implied by the uli in Maoli, which means dark. And the new moon is going to be tomorrow at 10:09 p.m.
Wow, far out. That's really interesting, because these days when the moon is up all day, I often call it the ghost moon to myself, because you have to really look to see it up there, the way it kind of hovers. Excellent. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, Wednesday and Thursday, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. And then we will tuck into the new moon around 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday, the moon will enter Gemini, an air sign, making it a good time to work with our flower plants. We will also enter the transplanting time as the moon reaches its apogee and heads down, descending back down. Good time for planting, especially good, according to the calendar. And so we can plant flowers like sunflowers, marigolds, etc., any of your lovely flowers, even some of our perennial things like roses and the like. On Sunday, the moon will be in Cancer, a leaf sign, making it a good time to work, a water sign rather, making it a good time to work with our leaf plants. And so we'll be planting greens and other leafy crops around that time. Monday, the moon's in Leo, a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruit plants typically, although for some reason, the calendar suggests flowers on this day, and I'm actually not certain why. I think it must have to do with some other planetary aspects that I'm unaware of. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Leo still. Now they are giving a fruit suggestion for Tuesday planting, so we can get into planting things like tomatoes for instance,
yes,
or peppers or eggplants.
Which we're really excited to sink our teeth into as well later on in the program. Right now, we'll cover some notable news topics important to us growers, and we're going to give a focus to the GMO banana, which is being developed and grown in Australia to be taste-tested in the United States for the African market. It could certainly find its way to many of the subtropical and tropical parts of the world. India is another target where this crop could be grown. And this is a I got a combination of sources from RT.com, The Guardian newspaper, and Smithsonian website. Bananas have been developed with increased vitamin A content over standard commercial varieties. This variety was created at the Queensland University of Technology in Australia through support by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And one of the lead researchers there notes that 650,000 to 700,000 children worldwide die each year, and at least another 300,000 are going blind from vitamin A deficiency. So clearly a very real problem, and the solution that is being addressed is one of a number of different solutions that could be taken, and this is very similar to the golden rice issue that we've talked about on the show before. A GMO variety of rice that had vitamin A boosted in it. The funny thing is that none of these articles that I've ever read on golden rice or on this new GMO super banana is that there are actually many other crops that could be grown that have a much higher vitamin A content that would be very suitable for the same growing places in the world, sweet potato being perhaps the largest example in terms of the quantity of vitamin A that's naturally found in it. Carrot and pumpkin also have very high levels, and there's many other crops as well that could be grown. And then with bananas in particular, there are very high vitamin A containing naturally occurring cultivars of bananas. There are many thousands of banana cultivars, and while they are not the commercial varieties necessarily, nature has provided for bananas that are high in vitamin A. And so why we are developing other bananas in the laboratory rather than depending on the traditionally bred crops, which could be said in general for GMO agriculture, is why are we using this technology when nature gives us another way of doing it, basically.
Sure, and as we learned with our lecture a couple weeks ago, John Navazio, there's so many options for classic plant breeding that can certainly bring us the vitamin A we need out of our bananas without really having to go into the laboratory to do it.
Truly. Bananas are more challenging because it is a crop that's by and large lost its ability to produce true seed, and so crossing bananas is difficult unless you're working with that much smaller subset of varieties that actually still do produce seed. However, it has been selected for thousands of years, and there are thousands of varieties that could be used. And if you are interested in this issue, as our friend Vandana Shiva is, you have the opportunity to visit her website and sign a GMO banana petition. So she's calling on the Indian government to stop expending funds in the trialing of this GMO banana in association with that University of Queensland research group. Interesting, too, that the bananas are being tested in the U.S. So basically they grew these bananas in Australia and they're shipping them to the U.S. to test on humans. And then if the tests go to their liking, then they will be released for growing in Africa. So very interesting that they would be depending on the taste buds of Americans to decide whether or not this is a crop that's applicable to folks who would be eating them in Africa.
Geez, can you say guinea pig?
Exactly. So hopefully some starving college students are making a little bit of money on showing up for those tests and don't have any long-term effects. But if you're interested in voicing your support of biodiversity and depending on instead of GMO monocropping, which Vanda Nashiva is quite concerned that, you know, if this is a high-yielding variety with the vitamin A potential, it's just going to further spawn monocropping and the loss of traditional varieties that are being cultivated. And so she's calling for folks to sign up. And if you're interested, you can go to their website, navdanya.org. That's NAVDANYA.org. Or simply do a web search for GMO banana petition, and that will actually give you the very specific link there. And finally, on the banana topic, there is some good news that a new banana cultivar checklist was just introduced by it's actually from Bioversity International, which is an international organization that focuses on crop diversity. They're headquartered in Italy, but they have researchers and collaborators all over the world. And they are collaborating, in this case, with an organization called ProMusa. Musa being the generic name for bananas.
Bananas, yeah.
And so ProMusa.org, if you go to their website, ProMusa.org, and click the Knowledge tab, you will find this banana cultivar checklist. There are currently 5,590 names listed, and the basic idea here is it's an effort to assemble the names and determine synonyms or plants that are the same variety but have a different name, as well as homonyms, which are that they have the same or similar name but it's actually a different variety. And we see this on a regular basis here in Hawaii, where the names get all confused. So this is a first big step to gather up all those international names and try and figure out which are the same, and it's going to help researchers. And for folks here who are not researchers but want to learn more about bananas and some of the research that they've done, they link information on the source documents or literature where these names came from. And funny enough, the first one I clicked had information about research on Panipe varieties of bananas that are high in vitamin A. So roundabout, just acknowledging that we have access to bananas in the world that can meet our nutritional needs, and we get to perpetuate local culture and traditional knowledge as well.
Wow, that's a lot of bananas to think about there. I do really appreciate that website for bringing all the names together and trying to sort it out, because it can get really confusing. And if you want to start selecting for the banana kind of bananas you want, you kind of need to start with some kind of language.
Yes, and I noticed that there were a number of bananas that were plugged in by our dear friend Angela Kepler, who's such an amazing banana knowledge holder, researcher, and cultivator of bananas over there on Maui. And yet there are many names that have not been included in terms of varieties that are being cultivated in Hawaii. So an opportunity, if you're growing some varieties, to have them added as well to the database.
Super cool.
Yeah. So this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Coming up in this hour, we have Pest Problems Solved and Soil Secrets Revealed with Kauai farmer Dylan Strong. But first, any more notable news from you, Robin? All right, well, we're going to head over to cracking open the medicine chest. And we like to have a look at various plants that are used in the local context for healing. And today we're going to focus in, since we are doing a focus on the Solanum family or the Solanaceous family, we're going to focus in on a much cherished native plant, and this is the popolo. The botanical name, Solanum americanum or glossy nightshade. Have you got this growing in your garden?
Oh, yeah.
Around your place?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I do. Some form of it.
Yes. And this is a plant that people do cultivate from time to time, just get started, but it is just such a prolific, I hesitate to say weed because it is native, but it is a component of the native or the natural landscape, if you will, and certainly can be a weed in the managed garden. Very fast growing, and certainly was one of the first native, non-planted by humans plants that came up in our food forest in profusion. It is an annual or short-lived perennial shrub-like herb, 3 feet tall, simple alternate leaves up to 4 inches long, and it's noted that it is native to tropical and warm temperate areas. It's thought to be indigenous, but it could have been a Polynesian introduction as well. Just no definitive discovery by the botanists here in Hawaii, like a fossilized seed or something like that. It was proven that it was before Cook's arrival from a discovery in the Mauna Kea Adze Quarry. There were some seeds found, which was abandoned before Captain Cook arrived, but whether or not it's indigenous, hard to say. It's found pretty much around the tropics, and humans have introduced it because it is valued as a medicinal plant, but also as a food plant. However, need to let folks know it may be toxic, and the toxicity of it is really dependent on so many things. It could be the environment, it could be the strain, and it could be that it hybridized with another more toxic species. Here in Hawaii, there was some concern that that was the case, and perhaps that's not the case because, according to the Smithsonian and National Tropical Botanical Garden database on the native and naturalized plants of the Hawaiian Islands, they don't have the Solanum nigrum, which is a very close relative, which can be a lot more toxic. It doesn't actually have that listed, whereas previous reports said that that was introduced from the continental United States. However, it still has some toxicity, especially the green fruit needs to be avoided. It could be more toxic to children than adults. And so it's not one that we're encouraging people to use, but we can report that it is used as a food plant in many tropical countries, very important in terms of its greens as a pot herb or steamed vegetable, as well as the ripe berries are eaten. And Bernice Krause, who wrote a few fine books on native plants of Hawaii, remembers as a child her mother sending her out to fill a pail of popolo berries on a Saturday morning so that she could make pies out of them.
Whoa.
So apparently they're not super toxic if they're ripe, as long as it is the correct strain.
Well, also, it's very interesting because in the Solanum family, the fruits may have, and especially green ones, I think in general, have toxicity, but it's the leaves, I thought, that were really toxic to eat. So it's interesting to know that this plant is cultivated for its leaves too.
Yes. The solanaceous crops sort of store their toxins in various parts or during various growth stages of the plant. So with all the solanums, it's very important to know when to eat them and when not to eat them, when to best just appreciate their beauty. So they have beautiful black glossy berries. You've probably seen them even if you didn't know what you were looking at. This plant is the kinolau, or physical embodiment of the god Kane. It's one of several forms that he takes along with ko, sugarcane, kalo, taro, ohe, bamboo, avapuhi, and ieie vine. And it was considered at the time the foundation of Hawaiian plant medicine. And it's used in combination with many things. It's used as a dye for purplish-black color. And it could have been that the dark color of the berries elevated its value as a healing plant because as students of traditional medicinal knowledge know that it's not just the physical properties of the herb, but it is the spiritual properties of the herb that are taken into consideration and are revered and are thought strongly to have an influence on the healing process. And so in the Hawaiian tradition, plants that were dark or hiva were preferred for healing and sacred offerings. And so because this is the glossy black nightshade plant, it probably was elevated from that spiritual significance as well. And so here are some of the uses from tradition. And again, we hasten to say that we are not advocating folks to use this without the help of a professional guiding you through this, but these are just some of the historical uses. Taproot was used in combination for asthma and an abdominal trouble, including perhaps appendicitis. Leaves and berry juice is good for the respiratory tract issues and as a laxative. The crushed leaves and salt to heal cuts and wounds. Anything with salt in your wounds, I'm not sure if I would be rushing out to do that myself, but they say it's quite effective. Steamed leaves to cure a cold. Leaf poultice to the stomach to cure indigestion. Juice of the leaves plus sunbathing for swollen tendons. Berry juice in combination for treatment of cataracts. Mashed leaves as poultice for inflamed eyes. And the leaves in combination with a lye or the red clay, which we sometimes find in our pa'akai or Hawaiian sea salt, was used for a general debility or weakness and for expecting mothers. So assumedly this is a note of the good vitamins and nutrients that are found within the plant that make it such a valuable pot herb around the tropics. And I told you that we were going to talk about the fontanelle earlier in the show, and that's the soft spot on a baby's head that allows for the cranium to rapidly expand while the brain is growing faster than the bones can keep up with it. So you've got various very firm but stretchy, rubbery material, which is the fontanelle. And this plant, the popolo, was pounded and the poultice was put on a newborn's head to close the fontanelle, but also to remove illness. It was thought in the ancient Hawaiian tradition that all children were born with some kind of illness that needed to be cured so that they could grow healthy and strong. And so this plant, again, from a more of a spiritual standpoint, was removing this illness along with prayers and strong intention from the parents for a healthy child. So this is popolo, Solanum americanum, the glossy nightshade. I certainly have eaten the berries on many occasions, but along with many of the solanaceous plants, we need to be very careful and sure that we're eating them at the right time. And so we encourage people to do their own research.
Sure. It's funny. I've always been a little bit afraid of eating the berries. And I have to say, after listening to you, I'm really not any less afraid to eat the berries at this point. So very interesting. I know in traditional medicine, so much of the time they feel illnesses are brought on by bad spirits of some kind. And it sounds to me that that's part of the routine with the baby's soft spot is, you know, curing a baby of a disease.
Right.
Maybe it was a
well. We're so young. When we are young, we are so, in a way, defenseless. I mean, we have the mother's protective energy, but we are we're definitely susceptible to influences that could take us down. And so, give thanks for the healing plants that can assist the mother in ensuring for a safe passage through our infancy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
for sure.
So this is In the Garden on the Farm, and you're joining us today to focus in on the solanaceous crops. That's our focus this month, and we have discussed the plethora of plants in the family Solanaceae, and as we do, we move toward figuring out how we can best cultivate these plants. Last week, we focused in on good growing of tomatoes and their kin. And this week, we're very fortunate to have a special guest in the program who has a great love of this plant family. And So we want to introduce our special guest in studio, Dylan Strong. Dylan is the owner and operator of Growing Strong Farm, a one-acre farm in Mulawa'a on Kauai's northeast shore that utilizes organic method pest control and fertilization strategies. Dylan and his team are dedicated to bringing the highest quality organic produce to market without harming the land, environment, or the people. Their bountiful harvest includes beans, beets, carrots, cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, kale, lettuce, and watermelons, just to name a few. So without further ado, welcome to the program, Dylan. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I sure was grateful to discover that you and Robin were friends, and that Robin, as she's pretty good at influencing folks to be generous with their time and effort, and I know you're such a hardworking farmer, so it's really an honor to have you come out of the field and join us in the studio and share some of your knowledge with us.
It's always a pleasure to talk farming, especially tomatoes. They're our favorite for sure.
Yeah, that's great. We feel the same way. I mean, we spend a bunch of time here every week talking farming, and so it's always so good to have people who are enthusiastic and also really good at what you do.
Can you start out by telling us a little bit more about your farm?
Absolutely. The farm was started about 5 years ago, and it started out really green as far as me and my partner at the time, Jaron Ramsey. We didn't have a huge amount of farming experience, but we both really wanted to grow crops that weren't being grown on the island, specifically tomatoes, cucumbers, watermelons, and bell peppers.
Brave souls.
all the really challenging stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I had just come from the Bay Area and just serendipitously ended up working at a farmer's market over there without a huge amount of experience growing up on Hawaii with North American, you know, seasonal produce. Over here, you just, you know, everyone knows how it is with the mainland produce, and we don't have any clue about seasonality. So for the first time, I saw flats of heirloom tomatoes, and I didn't even like tomatoes at the time, but I was just so struck with the beauty of these tomatoes and their diversity. I had no idea. It was a total eye-opener, and that was the moment where I was like, oh, I gotta do this somehow, you know. I gotta be a part of this. I want to grow these. I want to eat these. And
so these are the tomatoes that come in just a rainbow of colors.
Exactly.
And crazy shapes.
All kinds of shapes. And
yeah. And the flavor.
Right. They look, they taste as good as they look.
That's what we're aiming for. Yeah, well, with such a huge array of varieties out there to choose from, how did you decide where you were going to start variety-wise?
That's a good question, because we did want to try and do the heirlooms. And to clarify, now we actually don't grow heirlooms tomatoes. We grow beefsteak tomatoes, but they are not technically heirlooms. So, but our first crop were heirlooms. In these makeshift homemade greenhouses that weren't really up to par to growing tomatoes. And we were working part-time on another farm, so we didn't have a huge amount of time to dedicate to this first crop of tomatoes. But we did end up getting a lot of plants in the ground, about 300 tomato plants.
Wow.
And we ended up covering them kind of halfway. So, which was actually a benefit, because I think they set a better fruit outside of the plastic. So we did get some fruit. We grew about 6 different varieties. They were all heirlooms. They were all indeterminate tomatoes. And we had a little bit of success. We lost a lot to caterpillars and some to fruit flies, some to mice. So we saw a little bit of hope.
They were your first customers, and they were very grateful.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So it gave you enough encouragement to try.
There was
again.
A glimmer. There was a glimmer. Yep. And we, you know, kept playing with varieties, kept playing with the growing space. We were seeing that summertime was maybe they were having some heat issues, and they would set a couple sets of fruit, but eventually they would just be these gorgeous plants with not a fruit on them. So that was really frustrating. And we started experimenting with screen in the summertime and plastic in the wintertime. And we kind of found that the in-between seasons, autumn and spring, were the best periods to grow tomatoes for us.
Hmm. Is that maybe because in the summer the days and nights are too warm, and in the winter the nights are a little too cool? Or
possibly. Hmm. They don't seem to like hot nights as far as getting a good large fruit set. And a lot of research I've done kind of confirms that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the summer, if you're growing under plastic, you can hit 100 degree temperatures easily in the summer. And tomatoes, they can't set fruit over about 90 to 95.
Mm-hmm.
Unless maybe they're hitting 60 degree nights where the plants get to cool down and rest. But mm-hmm. ideally for them is 70 to 85 degrees days and 60 to 70 degree nights.
Mm-hmm.
So even a cool-ish night, I think they kind of enjoy.
Well,
you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm, and we're speaking with Dylan Strong of Grow Strong Farms in Molawa'a, and he is probably hesitate to say himself on his way to being a master tomato grower, but he certainly knows a lot more than I do and a lot more than many people on the island, and the success that he's having is showing that. So we're gleaning some great skills and some great lessons learned from him.
Sure, and the proof is in the pudding. They taste so good. Oh my gosh. So do you grow your tomatoes indoors, I guess is my big question.
Well, they're always protected by some means.
Mm-hmm.
So half the year we do grow them in traditional hoop houses. They're 20 by 96 feet, and they have 4-foot screen sidewalls with plastic over the top, and they reach about 10 foot tall at the highest point. So they're not huge structures. They're really basic. They are greenhouse kits. And there's actually a grant we got for them from the NRCS. I would encourage people to look into that. It's a hoop house grant through this conservation service, and they'll basically give you a free hoop house.
Very
That's
cool.
Great.
Yeah.
And so this place is big enough to so you can go in. You're working inside it.
Right. There's three. It's big enough. We have it set up with three about 4-foot wide beds, 4-foot by 96 beds. And, yeah, it's enough space to grow a lot of tomatoes.
Yeah, so with that much length, I'm guessing that you have seen your fair share of pests, because
sure.
I would think that ventilation kind of
right.
becomes a bit of an issue in such a long
right.
growing
we
space.
We do have four direct current solar powered fans.
You got fans, yeah.
So that helps a lot.
It helps with pollination as well, right? Isn't that the plants need to be?
These
do you ever
fans
have to
aren't
vibrate
too,
them? Or?
Well, I was going to get into that. Okay. That I think pollination hand pollination I think is a must if you're growing indoors, and that's something that we kind of learned over the years, because you can get a fruit set. I just think you'll get a much better one.
Okay,
you dedicate time to hand pollinating.
I've hand pollinated squash blossoms, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it sounds way sexier than it really is when you have to get down there every single
oh,
day.
Oh yeah, it's a pain.
So I've been reading about these little, they call them like vibrator bees or
yep.
something. These little vibrator wands that
right.
act like bees.
Right.
And do you use those?
We do. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
oh, cool. Tell us about them.
It's called a Veggie Bee Pollinator.
Yeah.
And it's available. We got ours through, I think, Territorial Seed Company. And if you are going to hand pollinate tomatoes, the best time to do it is between 10 and 2 o'clock.
During, middle of the
during
day?
During the day, yeah. That's when the pollen transfers the easiest. Mm-hmm. So tomatoes are self-pollinating, but they need that pollen to fall off by some way, either wind or bumblebees, because honeybees, in my experience, don't really actively pollinate tomatoes.
Right. So when you say they're self-pollinating, each flower provides the pollen that it needs for fertilization.
Right.
Yet if the plant is in the wrong environment, like you said, heat, or if it's a still day,
right,
or whatever,
right,
it doesn't actually happen.
Right. The pollen won't fall off the flower, and sadly that flower cluster will fall, you know, fall right before your eyes. You go to pollinate it, or maybe just tap it, and every fruit will fall off the cluster. It's heartbreaking.
For sure. Well, so how do you deal with your pest problems? We're curious what your main pests are that you deal with, and your best methods for handling them and still getting your crop.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of competition. As far as insect pests, I guess that's where we would start, because there's also, you know,
other diseases.
Yeah, and then rats, and I guess rats are the biggest one. Snails sometimes too, but back to insects, spider mites can be extremely, extremely destructive. There's that, what's that stink bug type?
Oh, the keeled tree hopper.
Keeled tree hopper, I've had really bad experience with. And
White flies.
I actually haven't had any personal problems with white fly.
Oh, let's knock on wood.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Those two, I'd say, are the biggest.
Mm-hmm. So spider mites, I know what their damage on a leaf or a plant looks like. How does that affect the fruit? And or can you still get a harvest even if the plant has some of these pest problems going on?
Sure. Spider mites can completely take over and probably will eventually destroy your plant if they are in a large enough population. Mm-hmm. And they'll deface the fruit.
They blemish it.
And it has this really weird kind of golden spotted look.
Mm-hmm.
And I notice it definitely decreases the taste and quality. It's like they suck all the good, nice juice out of it. And it looks funny. It tastes funny. And they're a real bummer. And there's not... If there's a big outbreak and they're all over your plant, I would just recommend starting over and removing that plant, because there's probably no saving it.
Sure. And so if you have a plant that's growing in a larger population like you do, or even for some of us in the garden, we might have a few tomato plants. I mean, the only thing I've learned to do is to gently bring a trash can with a trash bag in it and a lid, and then like slowly take cut pieces and kind of put it right in the trash can,
keep the lid
on. Because if you get in there and start tearing, they're just going to jump onto the other plants, right?
So the best pest strategy I would recommend for these insects are soil fertility. Because if your plant is healthy and vigorous, especially with spider mites, they seem to be really drawn to plants that are suffering from drought, suffering from maybe a calcium deficiency,
mm-hmm.
or both. Those kind of go hand in hand a lot of times, or possibly an overwatering. Mm-hmm. So if I know the home gardener, a calcium foliar might be a little bit out of reach, but I would, there's a really simple recipe on the internet. You can find it anywhere. It's for an eggshell
mm-hmm.
extract it's connected to that Korean natural farming.
Yes.
And basically it's just your eggshells kind of lightly toasted in the oven to burn off any organic matter, and mixed with, I think, some...
brown rice vinegar.
Yeah, brown rice vinegar. I think you can probably use unpasteurized apple cider vinegar. And
mm-hmm.
that, I haven't tried it personally, but it makes a lot of sense. And it's easy and free, and I think it could really benefit tomato plants because they're huge consumers of calcium.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, how much do you depend on soil testing to know what you eventually apply?
I'd like to use more testing, but we do it maybe like once a year. Mm-hmm. So I guess I use a little bit more instinct than testing based on soil tilth and stuff like that. But
well,
I would,
you've been observing and paying attention,
yeah,
and you
absolutely
watch your crops.
Absolutely.
So.
But I would highly encourage soil testing, because that, and then tissue testing too, if someone wants to get really into it and maybe wants to diagnose a problem that is, seems undiagnosable. If you get a tissue test, it's about, you kind of need a lot of tissue, and it needs to be from a, like, the certain types of leaves, but you can get a total breakdown of what that plant actually has in it, so.
Which might be different from what's in
exactly,
the soil that's
exactly,
unavailable to
exactly.
the plant for whatever reason.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we definitely want to get into talking about soil prep a little bit more later in the show, but in the meantime, how do you deal with the keeled tree hopper? I mean, this thing has been such a problem for me in my outdoor, you know, any solanaceous crop.
Really. Right. And I would say, too, they do attack a lot of other stuff. You just might not see them in the large quantities that you do on tomatoes. And for people at home, they oftentimes they cover the whole stem, portions of the whole stem of your tomato plant, and they have little spikes on their backs, and they're kind of, I think they're sucking insects. They're probably just feeding on the trunk of the tomato plant. But
yeah, I've had them suck a plant completely dry. The first time I met them, I saw some, and then all of a sudden it looks like pestilence. I mean,
whoa.
There's like thousands of them.
Right.
And I noticed that there were both ants and these little green guys.
Right.
And it turns out the little green guys are the adults who have laid eggs in the stems of the plants. And then these little nymphs that look like horned aphids is what I used to call them before I learned what they really were. And it seems like not much as far as product in the organic world really seems to do much against them.
No, I've done a little bit of research. I guess Pyganic, which is kind of your strongest organic pesticide, will kill them. But, you know, it's going to kill all your beneficials also.
Sure.
Which you probably don't want to do. So the best thing I think you can hope to do against them is preventative, you know, keeping your plants really trimmed out. Tomatoes like to have their old leaves trimmed off. You know, if your plant, you can start trimming the bottom leaves of your plant around the first fruit set you see.
Mm-hmm.
You can just take off the bottom two or three leaves of your plant, and it'll put more energy towards the rest of the plant. It'll create a lot of airspace and airflow, which will prevent disease, and it'll make it easier to see your tomato plant, and that's what you want to do on a daily basis if you have the time, because that hopefully you'll see your little outbreak of these leaf hopper guys, and you'll just be able to, they are spiny, so be careful squashing them, but I would just try and use a hand pick method. That's what I've done, and I've gotten pretty good control.
Yeah, I've experimented with the shop vac I was mentioning earlier.
Right.
I plug in an extension cord and, you know, get the shop vac way out there in the garden, and I've been able to just vacuum them right
That's
off the
genius.
Plant with very little disturbance to the rest of the plant.
Right, and that way you get all of them.
And then do you practice catch and release, Robin? You take them out to a nice place where they can reestablish themselves?
No, I put them in a bucket of boiling water. I'm pretty evil like that.
We're speaking with Dylan Strong on In the Garden on the Farm, all about conquering pest and disease problems in regards to growing tomatoes specifically. And so we've conquered some of the insect pests, but you mentioned rats are a big problem.
Definitely.
And with so many crops, but they're after the tomatoes, hey?
They love a ripe tomato, even a green tomato if they're desperate. And the biggest prevention I can tell people is try and have your tomato trellised and have your fruit off the ground as high as possible, pretty much. And that'll help your tomato plant. It'll grow a lot better. It'll, you know, help the aeration again, and you'll get a lot less losses to rats, because just that little extra effort that they have to do, I'm sure they could climb the plant, but in my experience, fruit that are sitting on the ground or close to the ground are about 10 times more likely to get hit than if they're just a little out of reach. So,
and slugs and snails the same way, probably.
Absolutely.
If it's on the ground,
even more so, yeah.
Anymore.
Definitely. And they too love a ripe tomato. And that's what I would almost recommend people at home, if they are growing them, to just pick your tomatoes right when they have a little blush of color. Because in my experience, it doesn't hugely affect the flavor and puts a little less stress on your tomato plant not having to do that extra ripening.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just guaranteed your tomato. It's every day you leave it on there, your chances are dropping, right? That
sure.
being said, we do pick ours vine ripe.
It is a competition of sorts out there.
You know,
who's going to get it
right,
first? And
right.
I'm usually like, it's going to be me. So
sure.
I'll pick it a little early if that's what's called for. Well, I find it interesting, both with the trellising, I get a little lazy sometimes and I don't really tie the branches up quite the way I should. I mean, in your hoop house culture, do you kind of splay them out almost espalier style where they're the branches are really spread and
yeah. And I mean, the better trellis you can give your plant, the better your plant's going to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
That with that comes, you need to know what kind of tomato you're growing because there's indeterminates and there's determinants.
Sure. I mean, most people I know of grow indeterminants here.
Sure.
Have you ever played around with determinant varieties?
Oh yeah.
And
we mostly grow determinants.
You do.
Because they are, in my experience, way hardier, way bigger fruit set, and yeah, they're just a little bit superior tomato commercially for the commercial grower.
Sure, because you get your harvest and
you're
then you can kind of start
harvest.
Over
yeah.
with another crop.
Right,
and
right.
Not...
They don't, just for people at home, the differences between a indeterminate tomato and a determinate tomato is indeterminate tomatoes are your vining tomatoes that want to grow up. They have an unlimited lifespan. You know, as long as you can keep them healthy and alive, they'll grow and produce tomatoes.
From the leading branches, right? So
right.
you have to find room for all this vine.
Right. Well, if you are going to grow an indeterminate tomato, what we do when we grow them is we just prune it to one main stem.
Mm-hmm.
And every leaf node, every part where a leaf meets the stem, there's going to be a sucker that's going to grow out of your tomato plant. And if you have an indeterminate tomato, I would recommend taking those little baby suckers off.
Mm-hmm.
And just having one main stem because the plant will be a lot easier to manage.
Right, right. And the longer it's in the ground, the more chances you have of stuff like powdery, which is where I was
right.
headed to next, is powdery mildew. In trellising, I think if you're really good at trellising and you get the plant all opened up like that, then the airflow will decrease your likelihood. But I've noticed that if I leave brown leaves on the bottom of the plant, they naturally get a fungus as they're breaking down, and then it's pretty easy for that fungus to just leap onto the green leaves. So keeping them cleaned up, but how do you prevent or treat your powdery mildew when you see it?
Yeah, it's the foliar diseases are pretty prevalent, especially in the summertime with tomatoes. Well, all year round, but just pruning them, keeping them pruned, and if when you do see it, pruning the ones that are heavily infected off. And I'm sure you guys have talked about it before, but we've had really good success with milk
mm-hmm.
as a foliar disease treatment. And tomatoes, I haven't seen it work as well as on our cucumber crops, which
mm-hmm.
powdery mildew is a much bigger problem, but it's a pretty high dilution. It's 1 to 3 parts.
Mm-hmm.
1 part milk to 3 parts water.
Right.
So we've had really good success treating our powdery mildew with milk.
Wow. And do you find that like whole milk is better than skim, or have you?
We only use whole milk.
Uh-huh.
So I have nothing to go off of. Growers in New Zealand, I guess they only use skim milk, but it's like a main practice over there for zucchini and
sure, so. And is that the kind of treatment that you want to start almost as a preventative early, like before you even ever see powdery?
Yeah, yeah, and it mixes really well with other fertilizers, and I would kind of consider it a little bit of a fertilizer itself.
Hmm.
So you could just, if you're spraying your plant or fertilizing whatever, just maybe throw some milk in there, and yeah, it won't hurt, it won't stink, and it's good stuff.
Oh, I wonder if the plant gleans a little bit of calcium out of there.
I think
too.
So. Every time we do it, the plants are really happy.
Happy.
In addition to it being some disease prevention.
Yeah. So, what's your favorite spraying tool? Now that we're on spraying a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we've got, you know, a farm scaled tool. It's a mist blower. It's a backpack sprayer. It's gas powered. It holds about 4.5 gallons. It's from a company called Mariyama. Mm-hmm. And we got it from Kawamura Farms. It was about $800, so it's probably not something a home gardener would be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But it does blow the leaves up, and that's kind of crucial to your...
Because of its power.
Right. So it blows a mist, and it also blows air, so it covers the whole surface of the plant. It's a really awesome tool.
And the undersides of the leaves, which is mainly where you want to be treating for most stuff anyways, right?
Yeah, coverage. If you're spraying for any kind of disease or insect, thorough coverage, top and bottom of leaf, is key.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've been focusing so strongly on tomatoes, but you also pull off one of the other really challenging solanaceous crops, and those are the peppers. People dream of the bell peppers that they would like to be producing in their home gardens, but so often the fruit fly makes it impossible, and even the pepper weevil, which was a pest I wish I had never met. How do you handle that particular pest? It's just containment, I would imagine.
Right. The pepper weevil makes the fruit fly seem like a dream. I mean, it's smaller. It's harder to detect with your peppers. I mean, I don't even know how I would recommend someone at home to find a pepper weevil if they think they might have it. Well, basically, if your pepper plant is a gorgeous, huge pepper plant with not a pepper on it, you probably have pepper weevils. So they're the invisible killer, you know.
Right.
But
they're pretty predominant. I've actually bought pepper fruits at market and brought them home to find that they were full of pepper weevil, and only because I knew what their damage looked like did I not throw those in my compost once I realized they were, quote, rotted.
Right.
And they went right down the garbage disposal.
Right.
I'm like, I'm not.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So pepper weevil is pretty widespread on Kauai.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it seems like every pepper crop we do, towards the end of their life, you know, we get a little bit sloppy with our system, and they find their way in there. Thankfully, if we don't have a huge amount of land, but we do have enough land to plant our succession crops pretty far away. So right now we don't have a huge amount of peppers, but... we have had some really nice crops this year, and the way we do it is we actually grow them under screen, and it's a really basic system with PVC hoops that are 10 foot long, held in the ground with rebar, and a screen is just draped over those hoops.
Oh, nice. Nice. So you can get in and out for easy harvest.
Right. And this is a very fine mesh screen because pepper weevils are really small.
Like Rime kind.
No. You could use Rime. We were using Rime. We did have a little bit of heat issues. So we found this insect screening is what they call it. And it's a 10 foot wide, which is makes it kind of different.
Uh-huh.
We're speaking with Dylan Strong, and we're reaching close to the top of the hour, so we're going to go into our final segment, and that is Secrets of the Soil Builders, and we're going to talk about, and we've talked a bit about proper soil management in hoop house production, but let's focus in a bit more on some of the challenges there and how we can make the right management choices.
Yeah, I've pretty much blown it every time I've tried to grow indoor crop. I don't seem to get my soil just right. So I'm curious, Dylan, how you formulate your soils for such, flavorful crops.
Thanks. Well, I guess it starts with the compost, which we collect fruit. It's mostly fruit wastes from the Moloa fruit stand, which is right down the road, and they generate massive amount of fruit waste, and this is just gold, you know, for an organic farmer.
Especially a fruit farmer, because also in the Korean natural farming, you would use
fruits
for fruits.
Right.
So,
Definitely. Yeah. I never thought about that, but that's a good point. So we're able to make a really rich compost, and we make a lot of it. We have a tractor, so it's turned almost daily if we can, depending on temperature with the bucket. And it's a really intensive process, and we put a lot of time into our compost. And it's, in my opinion, the most important addition to your hoop house specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, because without any rain washing stuff away, you can create imbalances really quickly.
Right.
And so that I would actually try to stay away from chicken manure if you're growing inside a hoop house, and just kind of strong, harsh fertilizers, and just try and make as much good, well-composted compost as you can.
Sure, like, and you would blend that like 50-50 to your soil amounts or
you could just, you know, if you have your bed made, I would recommend not incorporating it too deep, keeping it within the first 2 inches of the soil, because the tomato plants, in my experience, they do go deep, but their feeder roots are right on the surface, and that's where they're going to collect all their nutrients. So if you kind of work from the top up, you incorporate your compost in the top 2 inches, and then throughout the growing season, top dress and mulch on top of that, and then maybe top, you know what I'm saying? You just kind of work up, and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the tomato crop, it's like you never even put anything down. The soil's digested it all, and it's just soil again. So
by focusing on making compost out of so much fruit and vegetable matter, as well as avoiding the chicken manure, you're reducing the amount of salt you're putting down.
Absolutely.
And
I think that's a big killer.
And salt buildup in an enclosed system like that is reported to be one of the big problems. And so when you actually are finished with the crop, do you do any extra watering of the soil, or do you remove the covering so that some rain can get in there and sort of balance it out?
That would be ideal, to just take off the plastic.
Right.
For nematode control and I guess other insect buildup, we actually let it dry out, which it's not a positive effect on the soil. Going in and working it after that, it's not, you know, ideal, but it does effectively control nematodes and pests for us in the greenhouse. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a restart. And we, even though we are growing under plastic, we do try and give our soil as long a time as possible
to rest,
right. We do about one cucumber crop and one tomato crop per bed a year in the hoop house. Mm-hmm. So that leaves a lot of time to cover crop and, you know.
Sure. And on the nematode front, I know that a lot of times you can encourage them with overwatering. So just quickly, like, what's a general watering strategy for your tomato crop? I mean, how much water are you really laying down?
A pretty good amount. Mm-hmm. The soil in there is extremely loose and, you know, it takes up a lot of water. We also incorporate coconut cure as a soil amendment, I guess, mixed kind of with the compost. And people can use peat moss, too, if they can't find the coco core. But I would recommend it because it's not nearly as acidic and it's just a better product. So that also kind of ups the water requirement. But, you know, just don't overwater. Just fill your soil. And definitely, I think you have a better chance of underwatering than overwatering, in my experience. Because hopefully you're working your soil really deep, you know, we use a broad fork inside the greenhouse. It's a great tool. It kind of takes the backbreaking work out of working the soil deep. And we don't really turn the soil ever in the greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't use any tillers or invert the soil. But we do work it deeply with the broad fork. And I think that's a big part of growing in the hoop house, is making sure your soil's nice and deep and workable, you know, loose.
Yeah, sure. Sounds like such a lot of hard work, Dylan. We're really stoked that you're willing to do it and bring such great tomatoes to us on the island. Can you let people know where your tomatoes and peppers are available?
Sure. Hoku Whole Foods is our biggest supporter, but there's a lot of others. We have a lot of watermelon going off right now, so they're kind of all over. They're recognizable by their black skin. They're called sugar babies.
Yeah.
You can find them at Banana Joe's, Healthy Hut, Papayas and Kapa'a. I said Hoku. Restaurants that are getting our stuff, or Javakai is a huge one. They also make the effort to put aside great food scraps for us.
Mm-hmm.
So big shout out to them. And they have really great coffee and food. And Oasis on the Beach. They're a big supporter. Common Ground in Kilauea. They're great too. So, and we sell directly from the farm. Dylan Carl Strong is a contact at Hotmail. DylanCarlStrong.
@Hotmail.com.
@Hotmail, or they can contact us through the farm's Facebook, Growing Strong Farm.
On Facebook.
Right.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
And what farmers markets are you guys at?
Just the Kapa'a one.
Wednesdays only.
Yep.
Well, good reason to make it out there to Kapa'a every week, I'll tell you that.
Well, yes, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing so much knowledge with us. I think for folks who are growing tomatoes and peppers, this is a leap forward in terms of tackling some of the challenges for good production and inspiring us forward by picking up some of your produce and tasting what success tastes like.
It can be done. That's what people should know, is that we were told that it, you know, they don't grow, they don't do well, and given the right conditions, they will thrive.
Hmm. Well, you know, there's a saying that says, the hard, we do right away. The impossible takes us a little while longer.
This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our special guest on the show today, Dylan Strong of Growing Strong Farm. And you can find him on Facebook and at various outlets on Kauai. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.
Bye.